you're so immersed in the environment when you're riding a motorcycle. Like if the temperature changes, you feel it. If you pass something that has a different aroma, you smell it. Like your senses are just so much more engaged, and it requires so much focus that, you know, it creates some space for your mind to move around and be creative, but it also creates an environment where there's no room for an invasive thought. So you can have this, you know, meditative-like experience on a motorcycle that is difficult to get with any other form of transportation. These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. Four years ago, I bought a new truck for the first time ever, and I was so excited. It was incredible. It smelled good. It felt good. I wasn't constantly afraid of breaking down, you know? It was awesome. But after I drove it for a couple weeks, I do the same thing that I always do, and the back seat it started to fill up with stuff. You know, I'm guiding elk hunters and deer hunters, and I'm duck hunting and I'm fly fishing, and all that gear just accumulates. And pretty soon, I wasn't able to take people with me anymore, and I was embarrassed. You know, people would ask for a ride, and like, "Nah, sorry, man, I've got too much stuff with me." But I couldn't put it in the bed because then it gets damaged by weather. So I go to the internet, and I'm looking for options, and I ended up buying a deck to drawer system. Now, this was a big purchase for me, but it's something that I felt like I needed, and it looked like it was going to be a good product, and it really was. Dekt came out with a new drawer system this year, and they've made some meaningful improvements over the previous one. You have almost no wasted space in your truck bed now, so you can access the sides of the drawers, and then the drawers roll a full 18 inches farther out, so you can actually access the back of the drawer even if you don't have a lot of arm reach. There's some really strong tie-down points on top that have a 400-pound load rating. So if you're going to haul something like a motorcycle or big coolers or whatever, you can really strap your gear down and make it secure. You can lock these drawer systems, so you can lock the drawers, or if your tailgate locks, then nobody can access the drawers anyways. So I actually feel like my stuff is more secure inside this drawer system than in the cab of my truck. That's a big deal to me. The complete deck system is made in America by Americans, and you know that that's something that I love and appreciate. They've got one that will fit in any truck or van that's been made in America in the last 20 years plus. You can go to dekt.com/sixranch and get free shipping. But just being honest with you, they get free shipping to everybody. I also, while you're there, want you to check out their deco line. So they've got a bunch of different boxes and storage containers that either fit on top of or inside of the drawer system. And those are built really robust. I saw the prototypes at an event this summer. I'm impressed. I'm excited to get my hands on them. I haven't yet, but the prototypes were super badass. And the ones that are in production model, they're available now over at dekt.com. So even if you just need a place for some tools, or you need a new bow case, or you know, something along those lines, go check that out. And if you're driving around right now and your back seat is just full of gear and you can't haul people around, maybe you should consider looking at the full deck drawer system, because it's a good piece of gear. It was a good purchase for me, and I hope it helps you. In the United States, there are about 15.2 million hunters. That's how many hunting licenses we sell in the country. And they spend around $21 billion per year, which breaks down to an average of $2,800 per hunter. Now, we need to be really smart about how we spend that money. You can't spend it on stuff that's going to break. Otherwise, you have to buy something else again, and you end up costing yourself even more. We also need to be smart about how much weight we carry in our packs, because that's a serious limiting factor. One way to remove about 5 pounds out of your pack without sacrificing your ability to find animals is to get rid of your spotting scope and tripod. Now, there's a time and a place for those things, and I carry both of them a lot. But if I need to go lightweight, I'm going to carry stabilized binoculars. And the best stabilized binoculars I have ever used are from Sig Sauer. They are the Zulu 6, and they just came out with a new pair called the Zulu 6 HDX. I use the 12-power magnification model. They weigh 21.5 ounces, and they have two modes of stabilization. So you throw the lever forward once, and that's going to stabilize the image. If you turn it off and turn it back on again, that's going to stabilize it even more. And I'm not kidding. It is more stable than if you're glassing from a tripod. It is absolutely incredible. You're going to be able to see stuff at just incredible distances and really break it down. Like, you're going to be able to tell the difference between a Billy and a Nanny mountain goat at a mile. You're going to be able to actually see if there's a kicker coming off that 4x4 muley that just popped up over the hill. They work great at early and last light. They work great at high light. They fit really well in my hands. Like, this was one of the first products that I asked Sig to make when I started working with them. And to no surprise, they were already on it. They were way ahead of me. But this is a really good piece of gear. I highly encourage you look into it. You can go to sigsauer.com. Look for the Zulu 6 HDX. It comes in a few different magnification settings, but the one that I like the best is the 12 power. Check it out. When did you buy your first motorcycle?
I bought my first motorcycle in 2014.
And how old were you then?
I was, 25 maybe, 24, yeah. Something around there.
That's a relatively responsible age to start motorcycling, I think. Like, if you start motorcycling at like 17 or 18, that's a little bit dangerous. I mean, there's always some inherent danger in riding a motorcycle, but man, as like a just starting to drive young man, you're probably going to make some bad decisions, take some extra risks.
I had a friend who was that guy, you know, in quotes, that guy who bought the sport bike at a young age, and he was always the rowdy one doing burnouts in his mom's station wagon at the Stop and Shop grocery store parking lot. And he got bunged up pretty bad in a crash. Yeah. And I'm a relatively safe guy in general.
Yeah.
So, it was a calculated choice.
Yeah. What made you want to get into it?
I, at the time, was starting to become aware of, my own, coming into adulthood, I guess, if you want to call it that, and making choices that would determine the course of the next few years of my life on some level. And I, at the time, was living in Boston, Massachusetts, working in a biological research lab, and had been a New England born and raised guy. So I wanted to explore. I wanted to go west. It was always a goal of mine. In my younger days, I wanted to be like a California surfer guy and skateboard all day and just do all the board sports. But as time went on, it was the mountains that really were like my big draw. I was sort of interested in the idea of buying like a, truck or SUV and doing the whole like rugged cross country drive that way. But at the end of the day, I also was an avid cyclist and loved life on two wheels and was commuting every day on a bicycle. And I was like, well, I'd rather see what the next evolution of this looks like on two wheels. And started diving into the world of like adventure, dual sport bikes, and really became infatuated with camping my way across the country and exploring it that way.
My understanding is that the average human, if there's such a thing, can produce about a tenth of a horsepower on a bicycle.
I haven't heard that, but I don't know.
Yeah. So you switch from that to many horsepowers on a motorcycle, and it's a different game altogether.
Oh yeah, a powered vehicle like just makes all the difference.
Yeah.
You can really take in your surroundings, and when I first bought the bike, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but I started doing like my early rides just in the area, and I would just do my like cycling training loops, and I was like, holy smokes, like this hillside is beautiful or that house is beautiful, because I wasn't just like pedaling hard and suffering and watching for cars and doing all the things that you have to do when you're riding a bicycle on a street, even in the most conservative manner, you know?
Yeah. If you're not just riding a bicycle, but like bicycling, it's pretty hard to smile. I don't ever see bicyclists smiling, but I smile on my motorcycle all the time.
Yeah. You can't not. I mean, it's, yeah, it's the, you get sore from it.
It's a thrilling feeling. It's a thrilling feeling. I started riding a motorcycle in college, and it wasn't like a real motorcycle. It was a Honda 200. So it was a dirt bike that I sort of convinced the state of Montana that it was street legal. And,
love Montana.
Yeah. Love Montana. And then I didn't get a real motorcycle until 2017, and I loved it. And I considered it like my feeling when I was riding the motorcycle, I often describe as like that Forrest Gump moment where, you know, you just want to keep running. Like I didn't want to get off of it. I just wanted to keep riding and keep riding. And, I've put, over 20,000 miles on that motorcycle now. And,
wow.
I used to ride it, all summer long to go teach elk hunting seminars and go to shooting competitions, whether they're a rifle or archery. And I would just have this mountain of gear on the back of this bike. You know, I've carried a lot of different types of luggage, but when I was doing that, I had big metal Touratech boxes, and then I would put a waterproof duffel bag over that. But I would also have to have a pack strapped on for shooting these 3D archery competitions because you're out hiking these courses. And then I'd have my bow smashed into the middle of that. And I remember showing up to an archery competition in Utah one time, and I'd been riding through like where the Bonneville Salt Flats are. And I'd ridden through Nevada, part of Nevada that day. And it was a big, long day. I think it was like a 600 mile day, which really is a lot for me on a motorcycle. And
big time. That's a lot of miles in a day.
Yeah. I got to this venue. I unstrapped all my gear. I set up my tent and I didn't really look things over. And when I got out on the course to sight in the next day, I had all these bugs that were plastered into my sight housing because it had just gotten out in the wind a little bit. I was like, how strange, you know, I bet nobody else out here is picking bugs off of the sight housing of their bow right now. But and then there's also something very interesting. There's a certain magnetism about going west, it seems. Like much of human migration throughout history has been westerly. And in America specifically, especially for Europeans, and for obvious reasons, a lot of them came from the East, but there's this continued magnetism that has transcended the centuries to pull people west. And you know, Horace Greeley famously said, "Go west, young man." And you know, we have some literary examples of that, but to this day, if you go to the East Coast, if you go to the Southeast, there is still this strong sense of like, if I want to scratch this itch of adventure, west is the direction that I need to go. And it sounds like that's what you were feeling.
Big time. Yeah. I mean, I'd be curious to explore how many different ways that dream manifests in people. Like, you know, the dream of someone looking to move to rural Montana or Oregon, I think maybe has a different flavor to it than someone looking to go to San Francisco or Los Angeles, sure, or something. But for me, it was certainly the former, and it was very much about the nature and the, you know, the space, because I grew up in a relatively rural setting in Connecticut. Granted, it's Connecticut, but you know, I wasn't in an apartment complex or a super dense neighborhood, and spent my days exploring the forest as a child. But it was a small space. Yeah. And, you know, when we would take vacations to Vermont, it was a slightly larger space, but still had, you know, visible limitations. And, you know, you read books and stories and look at pictures in nature calendars or whatever as a kid. And, you know, you see pictures of Glacier National Park or something. And that's just a fundamentally different, you know, different vibe altogether. And I was like, wow, that you know, so much exploring can be done there. That was the thing for me. But yeah, the westward expansion thing is a really interesting one. And there's even a theory that I can't remember if it was a TED Talk or podcast or something that talked about, like, technological advancements seem to, like, happen in, like, these westward moments where, like, you know, hundreds of years ago, you know, like, Europe and the UK were the first with, like, even, like, Iron Age type advancements. And then people came west, and then, you know, the US was where, you know, tons of advancement happened. And this, like, you know, you can trace this kind of, like, longitudinal, like, arc of, like, where advancements happen technologically. And right now it's happening in, you know, Japan with all the technology that they're coming out with that's, like, defining, like, new, you know, video games and things like this, and AR and all that kind of stuff. So this continually pulsing wave of, you know, interest going westerly.
It's curious. When I went to college in Montana, we studied a lot of, you know, quote unquote, Western literature. And I thought that it was interesting that what was defined as the West in that region, or within the spectrum of that literature, really was the region of, like, Montana, Eastern Idaho, Wyoming, even the Dakotas to an extent, Nebraska, like this slice. And I came from a place that was farther west than that. And I remember talking about it in discussion in some of this literature, and one of my professors, Alan Weltzien, who's a dear man, and I owe a lot to him. He said, well, Eastern Oregon is west of the West. And I always felt like this little bit of pride, this little glimmer about that, you know, I thought it was such a sweet sentiment. But yeah, there's the West, and then there's west of the West. And then there's the Pacific Northwest, which I think can be fairly cleanly defined by any place that a salmon can swim.
I like that.
Yep.
I like that.
Yep. If a salmon can't get there, it isn't the PNW.
That's a pretty good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good way to put it. I also like the idea that you were somehow on even the further cutting edge of the West.
Yeah. No, and this is a microcosm, this area that we're in here. You know, it's really standalone. It's an island. It's an interesting island, but what we're surrounded by is dissimilar from what we're standing in. And I find that fascinating. But that's a different story. So you're working in this bioresearch lab.
Mm-hmm.
That feels very different from what you're doing now, which we'll get into later. But what kind of motorcycle did you buy?
I bought a Kawasaki KLR 650.
Yeah.
With all due respect, the, like, lowest hanging dual sport fruit. Like, it is, like, so oft cited as, like, oh, you're getting into this? That's a great starting bike, you know?
And it is.
Yeah.
It's kind of a thumper.
Yep.
But you can get parts for a KLR anywhere that you need them.
Yep.
I often have conversations with people about, like, what kind of motorcycle would you want to ride around the world? And some people will say, well, like a BMW GS or a KTM 1090 or, you know, various other motorcycles. But I kind of think that I might have to pick the KLR. My motorcycle was down one time for an entire riding season because I couldn't get a specific spark plug that was proprietary to my motorcycle from KTM. That sucks.
That would hurt.
Yeah.
That would really hurt.
That was pain. Mm-hmm. And imagine if you were, you know, in Mongolia and you needed a part and KTM was like, well, it's back ordered for a year. That ruins it.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen with the KLR.
No.
It's probably in that scrap heap behind that shack with the tin roof, you know.
Yep.
You dig around in there.
Yeah. And it might be pretty used already, but it'll probably still work when you put it in there.
It'll get you a little bit farther down the road.
Yep. That was definitely part of the draw, because I had, you know, I had some real aspirations of some even bigger trips than what I went on.
Yeah. Something that some of these bush pilots say about the Super Cub and some of these bush planes, that they'll put, like, monster truck, you know, bush wheels and stuff on, they're pretty slow planes. Mm-hmm. And if you ask them how fast their airplane goes, they'll say just fast enough to kill you. And that's kind of what the KLR is too.
Very much so. Yep. Yep. Very much so. Yeah. Yeah. No, that was the bike I chose. And, you know, I figured I'd probably put it down once or twice. And,
yeah.
You know, it might not be the fastest rocket ship out there, but it'll go.
Yeah.
It'll go.
Yeah. And has for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. They made a million and millions of them. Yeah. They're a cool bike.
Yeah. I was never pumped. Had a problem with it.
I was pumped to hear that it was a KLR. So you started just riding around, kind of getting the feel of it. I can't imagine that riding a motorcycle on Boston traffic was a pleasant experience. It sounds terrifying.
It was, you're right about that. I mean, it was a pretty shocking entryway into motorcycling. I still commuted by bicycle, actually, mm-hmm. because my commute into like the heart of the research area where I worked was not going to be even remotely fun. Mm. Nor did it really, I think, like have any contributing factor to the skills I needed to prep for my cross country drive necessarily.
Yeah.
So I would save it for kind of longer trips on the weekend. But yeah, it was a pretty intimidating thing, and I'd be lying if I said there weren't some days when, you know, I was just on my way out of the city for one of those practice drives in the early miles where I was like, wanted to throw that towel in and be like, yeah, this is actually a lot, but I stuck with it and it was worth it for sure in the end. But yeah, it was a very difficult, daunting thing. Boston is not known for its kind, you know, driving culture.
No, Massachusetts drivers are not the best of humanity.
They're not. No, yeah. They get in those cars and they become damn near the worst possible versions of themselves sometimes. So,
yeah, no, those are, I one time had to fly into Logan, which is a difficult airport to escape from, and drive up to New Hampshire in a rental car. And I was just terrified. I was way outside of my, my normal operating envelope.
Yeah. Yeah. It's daunting.
Yeah.
It's daunting.
Okay, so did you have a cross-country trip in mind when you bought this bike?
Yes and no. I mean, I had a goal, mm-hmm. But I had not confirmed that that would be where I'd end up yet.
Yeah.
But I knew that I wanted to do it and that it would, you know, I was going to go west come hell or high water,
right.
You know. But no, I did not have the destination confirmed when I bought the bike.
Gotcha. So when did you make that decision?
I made it in short order. I mean, it was only a matter of, I'm going to say, weeks. Mm. It's tough to recall in hindsight, but I had the bike for some time, and a couple weeks later was able to confirm where I'd end up, which wound up being Pullman, Washington.
Cool.
Yeah.
So tell me about the trip.
Well, it was... I mean, it was very interesting. I had been planning this, and I had a very close friend of mine who I grew up with who expressed some interest in joining me, but not necessarily on a motorcycle. He wanted to do something new. I can't remember what he was doing for work at the time, but he wasn't putting his college degree to use per se, and was like, I need a change of, you know, I also want to do this sort of journey. So we chatted about it and came up with a plan and decided to kind of go tandem in a way. He went in his car and I went in my motorcycle, and we started with, the goal was to camp as much as possible, to do some backpacking out there along the way. And first night was in a Pennsylvania, you know, campground just on the border of a very large state park. And we made our way west from there. We tried to put in a lot of long days early because we wanted to spend as much time exploring the west as possible.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So what are some long days for you?
They were, I mean, I'd say the longest day that we did was only 400 to 500 miles.
That's a long day.
It's a long day. I mean, you know, you have me beat by quite a percentage at the 600, but you know, on a 650, yeah. on highway with, and I had like, you know, I had packed most of my things in a box that I shipped out, but right. I still had like the full dual sport bikes with the backpack strapped to the top. I was loaded up mm-hmm. and, you know, I was just a wind sail on the highway.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, we would do, I think 120, 150 miles at the time. And the KLR is a pretty lean and mean bike. So there's no gas gauge. There's no, you know, so it was constant checks as I learned how the bike dealt with that kind of mileage and stuff like that to really fine tune when I needed to gas up and things like that. But yeah, we'd go for a solid stint and we had no comms. So there was a lot of hand signaling and, you know, he wouldn't see it. So I'd get off and we'd catch up later in the day. And, you know, it was a trip.
That's kind of cool. So when did you get to a point in the trip where you started to kind of explore a little bit more?
I'd say the exploration really started, really as early as the Midwest, honestly. We were, somewhere in Illinois. I can't remember the name of the town at this point, but that was the first moment once we passed through kind of like the Iowa area. Ohio was the last development that I really remember. As soon as we hit Iowa, it was open. And as soon as we hit Illinois, it was like, you know, that was where we camped on a lake and had really full appreciation of the fact that we were in a different sort of like geologic area. You know, it did not look like the eastern seaboard anymore. Denver was where we really got to actually start living a bit. You know, we stayed with a friend and got tattoos in his basement that he did for us, and he had like just bought his tattoo machine, had no idea what he was doing. Like, yeah. You know, that was when, you know, we were in the true road trip mode by that point. You know, this is like 5-6 days in Denver. And then the real journey started in Grand Teton National Park just after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Well, we showed up to the ranger station late in the afternoon, and our goal was to probably have to use like headlamps to get to the first site, but we were hiking up in the sunset, which was beautiful. And the first thing that happened coming onto the trail was passing by this lake that kind of had the trail go up around it on a bench, if you want to call it that. And this massive moose with just the hugest shovels like you'd ever seen just started crossing the lake real slow, you know, picking at things in the water here and there. I think he saw us, but paid no mind at all. And you just see the Tetons directly above you, moose in a lake, sunset. And it was like, you know, it was such a great welcoming party, you know, to the West. It was like, yeah. Wow, okay, this is going to be.
That feels like the romantic version of what you maybe were expecting.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't have asked for a more like postcard experience, you know. And it was great. It was just great. We got up to the campsite and, I think there was a deer that was so comfortable around us that it was just like eating grass right next to the campsite. Right.
Yeah. And they get pretty habituated.
Yeah. 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 He didn't care at all. And my friend who was not, you know, comfortable, he was like, I think a little paranoid that it might be like rabbit or something that was going to attack us. And he was like, kind of trying to scare it off for a second. It just like looked at him and was like, dude.
Yeah.
What are you doing? And then he settled in and we all became friends.
Yeah. That's cool. Did you ever have any bear encounters?
I did not have any bear encounters, at least during that trip. We were quite concerned about that with the, you know, level of intensity that the ranger prepped us for how to stash the bear box while backpacking out there. But we did not have any bear encounter. In the Tetons.
That's good.
Yeah.
A lot of times those park bears get used to people and, you know, it escalates the problem, you know, really rapidly and can create that conflict. I've been in a few situations where I was sleeping on the ground next to my bike and, you know, had bears snuffling around me, and I don't like it. You know, there's no good way out of that situation, but you know, you just sleep with a 10 mil in your sleeping bag, and like, if he wakes me up, we'll deal with it then. And you know, if not, I'll just sleep through it, I guess.
Yep.
But, I almost hit a moose one time, outside Kamei, Idaho on Highway 12.
Yeah.
And I was clipping right along, and it's a windy road. It's got curves for, I think, over 200 miles that highway does. And I came close enough to hitting the moose that it actually crossed my mind to like try to lay the bike over and slide between its legs, because I didn't know if I could get around it. And I made the decision to get around it, and I was as close as I could possibly be. And
damn,
you know, that's an animal just based on, I don't want to hit anything on my motorcycle, but just based on their height, mm-hmm. like I'm hitting torso with my face.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to be a really bad deal.
Yeah. Yeah. The full on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clothesline.
And I've almost completely quit riding in early morning or late evening, because I just don't want to hit a deer.
Mm-hmm.
That scares the pants off of me to hit a deer on my motorcycle. I want nothing to do with it. I've hit a couple birds. I hit a pheasant with my helmet one time. I hit a quail with my hand one time. And both of those hurt.
But I bet.
I was all right. I wear all of the gear. I look like I'm about to invade Mars when I'm on my motorcycle.
Yeah.
Were you pretty well geared up as far as your body?
I was pretty geared up. Yeah, the only part of my body that I didn't have dedicated motorcycle specific gear was my boots. Mm. But I had, I think they were Doc Martens or something.
Okay.
I was in very much a budget mode at that point in time. So, you know, I got everything. I had like the summer weight kind of like vest that had a lot of vents but was fully padded all the way down, and the motorcycle gloves and yep, helmet. Yeah. I was fully kitted out, with the exception of the feet. But
I don't understand why people like riding a motorcycle without a helmet.
I have to say that I do, but I can't accept that the risk is worth that, you know, whatever sort of fun feeling it is to have the wind, you know, coming over you.
I mean, the bugs hurt.
That's a good point.
They're so painful. Like a ladybug to the cheek at 90 miles an hour is like brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will say that when I romanticize in my head helmet-free riding, it's like, you know, going from here to the coffee shop, you know,
right.
It's like sub 50 mile an hour.
Right.
But even then, you know, I've ridden dirt bikes, you know, a little bit in the backyard, and you 25 miles an hour, you hit a bug, and that's not fun either. Like,
yeah,
it's never fun.
And if you hit the ground with your noggin, it's real bad.
Of course, of course.
My order of precedent, and I actually owe this knowledge to Stephen Smith, who helped me when I was starting to ride my adventure bike, because he had a bunch of experience with it. My order is helmet, mm-hmm. boots, gloves. Like, every time, no matter what. So even if I were to go out and jump on my bike right now and ride it down my driveway, I would put those three things on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wreck, all three of those things are going to hit the ground. Like, your head, your hands, and your feet are all going to hit the ground at a high speed and probably cause injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, you know, I wear motorcycle pants. I wear, you know, a motorcycle jacket. I've got good padding all the way around.
Yep.
And what I've found is that stuff is pretty miserable to wear if you're walking around, but on the bike, it actually makes for a more comfortable experience, with the exception of, it can get a little hot. And then, man, have you ever been riding in the summertime when it's hot and then gotten stopped for construction?
No.
Dude.
No.
The worst. Because everybody else is just living it up in their minivan with the air conditioning, and you're sitting on top of this engine that was just running at 189, you know, degrees Fahrenheit or whatever. I don't know. It feels like you're sitting on an oven, and then you're wearing all this gear, and now you don't have any airflow, and you're just baking while, you know, you're waiting for a road grader to go past. It's like, oh my God, I'm going to die.
That would be insufferable.
Yeah. No fun.
No fun.
That's one of my no fun portions of motorcycling.
Yeah. And, you know, we tend to remember the least fun things because that's kind of where, like, you know, the adventure is or whatever. And I just remember having almost the inverse problem of that outside of Denver. Like, we saw this thunderstorm rolling in.
Oh, yeah.
It was just horrific. Like,
yeah.
It was angry.
Yeah.
And I stopped under an overpass and rode that one out. But that, I like... It was a perfectly fine temperature, but as soon as that storm came in, it just got miserably cold and is just pissing. And,
yep.
You know, I'm mostly dry, but cars are still bringing in the wet as they pass by. And yeah that was...
I had to hide under my motorcycle in Southwest Montana at Reynolds Pass one time because of a hailstorm. Like, the hail was just too brutal while I was riding. You know, it was hitting me really hard and I was afraid it was going to crack the visor in my helmet or... hurt my bike.
Mm-hmm.
So I pulled over, and then as soon as I pulled over, the hail got bigger and stronger. So I just tipped the motorcycle over on top of me and kind of used it as a shield.
That's awesome. That is amazing.
There is no place to hide out there. There is, yeah. But, you know, getting caught in those storms and all that stuff is such a cool part of the experience. And truly, like, you're so immersed in the environment when you're riding a motorcycle. Like, if the temperature changes, you feel it. If you pass something that has a different aroma, you smell it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, your senses are just so much more engaged, and it requires so much focus that, you know, it creates some space for your mind to move around and be creative, but it also creates an environment where there's no room for an invasive thought. So you can have this, you know, meditative-like experience on a motorcycle that is difficult to get with any other form of transportation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember those changes, especially as we moved west, where the temperature flux between, you know, AM and PM became more significant. You know, I remember coming over the mountain in the later aspect of the trip, like in like the Coeur d'Alene Sandpoint area, and just like smelling the pine, and I could even smell the lake, and just like, I was like, holy smokes, like, you come over this pass and you're just like, boom, like it hits you in the best way. And yeah, I feel really aware of where you are in such a good way.
I rode through that area this spring, I guess. Yeah. Late spring, early summer. And there was just a terrific rain event, inches of rain. And between Troy, Montana, and Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, the water was so deep on the highway that it was up to my foot pegs. And there was actually, like, you know, debris floating in the roads and stuff like that. And I was like, I'm like in a river, but there's... like, I'm sure that there's pavement underneath me, and I was just going slow and sludging through it. And, you know, the wake that would come off of other vehicles, especially trucks, it would almost knock me down. You know, there's just this monster wave coming over me.
You're dealing with like boating issues on your motorcycle.
Yeah.
That's a pretty unique experience.
Yeah. And I just wasn't in a good place to stop. And I made it that day. I made it from Kalispell, Montana, to Coeur d'Alene. And by the time it got to Coeur d'Alene, the rain had let up and I'd been able to dry out basically from Sandpoint to Coeur d'Alene. And I was just mentally exhausted, you know, and I had enough time in the day to make it home that day, but I just didn't have the brain power to be able to do it. So I just stopped at Coeur d'Alene for the night and came on home the next day. But it's incredible how mentally fatiguing it is.
Yeah, that's a really good point to touch on, because that was a huge learning curve for me, was like just the sheer mental load that it takes was, you know, really interesting to me. It gave me a lot of respect for motorcycles and motorcyclists in general, because it can be a lot, like, you know, windy days. I remember I got blown all the way like off the side of the highway, essentially, like over the line. And I had to pull over and just like take 20 minutes to just be like, you know, on some level, I mean, you're confronting like death every single time you ride, right? Like, 'cause there is that realistic risk that is like so much higher than an automobile, where you're in the box with the, you know, cushy bags that at least can try to help you. And yeah, it takes a toll on the mindset if it's like, if it's a tough day of riding.
Yeah. So you're not working in a biolab anymore.
I am not. I have left the biolabs behind.
What do you do now?
Now I am the social media manager at Decked, the truck bed storage solution company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. How do you like it there?
I love it there.
Do they treat you well?
They treat me very well.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Honestly, like you feel like they're good to employees?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, really empowering environment, you know.
That's increasingly a big deal to me.
Yeah.
Like not just like where is the product made or, you know, what's my use case for it? How good is the product? Like all that stuff definitely matters. But I also want to buy from companies that treat their folks well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's I'd say a core pillar of Decked. I mean, you know, we are certainly vocally customer first, mm-hmm. but, you know, it takes a team of people that all believe that to make it really happen.
Yeah.
And it's a very inspiring place to be.
Yeah.
It's a lot of young people with a lot of important decisions to make and, you know, full trust that they're all going to do that to the best of their abilities.
Are there any Decked products that you wish you would have had on your motorcycle?
Yeah, for sure. The D-bag would have been pretty cool.
Yeah.
In particular.
Totally.
You know, I had a soft bag set up on my bike, mm-hmm. Which was great, but the lack of structure made it, you know, dicey in some ways. Like when I put the bike down, you know, or things going to get crushed or right. whatever. And, that semi-rigidity just in terms of like having something more easily strapped down and that keeps its shape in the wind and stuff like that. D-bag would have been great. Along with some of the new cases, I think, I mean, if, you know, there was a time machine and the new cases could be bolted on or whatever to the bike at that time, probably would have also been pretty sick.
Yeah. You know, I run like NRS straps on mm-hmm. stuff all the time. So like if I'm packing like coolers or, you know, hard cases, stuff like that, a lot of times I'm just running, you know, my rafting straps over the top of stuff and mm-hmm. cranking it down. And, I think that having soft cases is really nice during the times when you're going to be dropping your bike a lot, because you know, you're going to change what you put in those bags for sure, mm-hmm. but you're not going to hurt the bag. Whereas, you know, like my Touratech boxes, you know, I still drop my bike from time to time. And like I dropped it during that trip, actually, that day in Libby, Montana, I stopped for gas and I, for whatever reason, I parked on the wrong side of the gas pumps and it was sloped downhill. Mm-hmm. And when I put my kickstand down, I started to get off the bike and then I felt it start to like go. And I tried to hook it with my leg as if, you know, I was going to stop a 500 pound motorcycle with the power of my hamstring. And down she goes. Yeah. And it, you know, I still need to hammer that box back into shape, which you can do. And that's great. But yeah, there's a time and a place for soft bags. And if you're going to do trail riding and things like that, anything that's single track, like just put on soft bags.
Yep.
But, you know, the new hard cases, I think, are going to be really applicable for that type of thing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have not kept up with the gear involved with like dual sport motorcycling, but I distinctly remember companies that would make like cages that could fit box of your choice, you know, or like brackets, you right. know, where you weren't beholden to one case, or they recognize that like there's always the risk that the case fails at some point because of a drop. Right. Yeah. So it was more of a mounting solution. And I see a lot of potential there as well.
And having like straps, because a lot of times like you're not going to be sleeping next to your bike. Like you're going to be standing at a buddy's house or going into a hotel or whatever. Being able to carry your storage from your motorcycle to where you're staying is really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And carrying Touratech boxes, you look stupid doing it. There's not a good way. It's, you know, it's like a pine squirrel carrying you know, a watermelon. Yeah. You know, it's just not a smart idea. So, yeah, I think the D-bag is actually pretty applicable. Tell me about your changing gears again here.
Yeah.
Tell me about your first time duck hunting. Well, first time hunting anything.
First time hunting anything. Yeah. 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 Well, you know, being in my 30s now, it just happened for the first time yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great things about changing industries has been the exposure to really awesome and new kinds of people with fundamentally different interests from those in the biotech field by and large. And, I had the pleasure of meeting you, recently at a DECT event, and, I'd say we became fast friends and bonded over some interesting events that occurred on the trip. And, I was lucky enough to have you invite me out here for a duck hunt when you found out that I'd been shooting my shotgun with pretty intentional practice for about 4 years.
Yeah. I love that you did that. I love that you practiced for that long. I also think the shotgun that you're shooting is cool. Tell me a little bit about the history of that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it's a 1968, Remington 870 Wingmaster, Magnum edition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the real nice old school walnut stock, I believe. And it's beautiful, but,
it's got that fleur-de-lis stamped into it.
Oh yeah. 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 Really nicely engraved. And it was certainly used, but it's in pretty good condition, all things considered. I wish I knew more of the history, but the real rationale for me to buy that gun was that my grandmother worked for Remington when they were based out of Connecticut. I think it was more of their ammunition manufacturing division. But she climbed quite high in their finance division at a time when, you know, between the 50s and 70s, when that was very much, you know, not an easy thing to do as a, you know, emboldened Eastern European woman.
Yeah.
She, you know, throughout the years was offered, like, at various decades of employment, certain, you know, gifts to celebrate her employment in the way of product that she turned down, which I only found out, you know, in my 20s as I started to really start pursuing a lifestyle that was so different from what I grew up with, but very much wanted to have.
What was her name?
Her name was Mary.
Mary?
Yeah. Mary Moyer. Yeah.
And you told me that, like, anybody that shares your name is related to you, basically.
In the U.S. or anytime I've searched on Facebook, yes, if they have my spelling name, they are my family.
So how's it spelled and where does that name come from?
It's spelled M-O-J-C-H-E-R, and it comes from a small village in eastern, what is now Slovakia, but when they left, it was still Czechoslovakia.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, very, very small village, somewhat close to the Poland border. Middle of absolute nowhere to this day.
My name is pretty dummy proof. Like, if you can struggle through, like, the basics of English, you can probably handle James Nash.
Yeah.
But I bet you've just had a lifetime of pain of people not being able to pronounce your name.
You can tell when people, you can really tell a lot about, like, the approach of a conversation based on how they try to guess your name, right? Mm. Like the early 2000s telemarketers who see your name only when they're trying to call you are only reading it that first time, you know? So they're like, oh, hi, can I please speak to Mr. And then you're like, oh, that's a fake one, you know? But they're like, hi, I'm looking for Russell. I don't know how to pronounce it, you know, or whatever. And I say Russell because that's my dad's name. But it's been a lifetime of people guessing Mosher, Moker, all these things
I think that my phone pronounces it pretty goofy too. Like, I've tried to hey Siri you a couple times. We had a hell of a duck hunt yesterday.
You know, it's one of those things where, like, it's almost bad in a way that I had that introduction because I'll never have such a great time hunting. Yeah. You know, we got lucky, it seems, but we had all the right pieces in place. I mean, I was such a lucky person to go out with yourself and Kevin from Kevin, what's his last
Kevin
name?
Kevin Harlander,
yep. Recent guest on the pod. Yeah, he's amazing and you're amazing. And we were just smoking them, man. Yeah. Walked away with limits and...
Yeah, we had 21 birds before 8 a.m., all mallards.
Yeah.
And one of whom was banded and is at least 8 years old, if not older.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. That's an old band. That's one of the oldest bands I've ever gotten off of a duck. And my good old dog just had an incredible day. It was interesting for me because something unique happened after that hunt that had never happened to me before, which is that I know now that, you know, this may be her last year of hunting. She's 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've probably only got a handful of hunts left in the season. She can only hunt about one day a week now, maybe every fifth day. She's retrieved, I think, around 4,000 birds in her life, maybe a little bit more than that, which is just me and my friends and family hunting over the top of her. She can't hear anymore, so she does everything on her own. With a little bit of help from hand signals, and she still does great. She picked up 20 out of 21 of those birds. One of them we picked up by hand. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, you know, we took a picture with her sitting on a log next to these ducks, and I had to pick her up to put her on the log because she was wore out and sore. But she went over to the front of the blind and sat down and looked at the sky over the top of that pond. And just wanted more of it. And it was just so incredible. It was so incredible. And, you know, people have a special relationship with hunting dogs. And I don't think that they have that with other animals. Certainly not in the same way. But that's a memory that I'll just hold on to forever. That was just pretty special.
Yeah, I remember that moment very vividly. And I stopped in my tracks because, you know, if she just... She lives for it, man, and she loves it with every fiber of her being. And it was a special moment, you know. Yeah. It was a special moment to see her, like, yeah, this is it, you know.
Yeah.
Like,
it's pretty cool.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
So it was, to say it was a special first hunt is, you know, the understatement of the century. Yeah. It was truly incredible.
And then we went out today and shot one duck.
Yeah, I saw, you know, a decent amount maybe of the spectrum of duck hunting. Yeah. Where you're just swimming in them and then you're just sitting there waiting.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's a lot more of the one duck and the no duck days than there are of the three limits before eight.
Yeah, yeah. See, if I could never let it happen, but if I only went on the one duck hunt, I'd have a phenomenal percentage, yeah. You know?
So you've gotten an introduction to hunting now. You're going to be going home with some meat. What is your move now to kind of determine your next steps? Are you going to continue hunting? Are you going to go back to practicing shotgun? Like how do you move forward at this stage in your life?
That's a great question. You know, I want to pursue hunting. I want to continue to hunt for sure. I'd say that I will not abandon, you know, the clay aspect because there's a just fundamentally enjoyable aspect of that. And I like to stay sharp and train mm-hmm. and practice things, you know, with whatever that hobby is, whether it's, you know, playing guitar or shooting or whatever. So I like to stay sharp, but, you know, you gave me some really great advice out in the field, which was, to speak to people in my community, farmers, fellow hunters, build relationships and find out where, you know, where the ducks are,
yeah,
where the birds are. You know, we have a mutual friend, Matt Harding, who hunts chucker. And I know that there's a lot of different types of bird hunting out there, mm-hmm. you know, so it's this whole new rabbit hole that I can kind of get yeah. into of, pursuing this. But yeah, the first thing is going to be, you know, building stronger relationships with people in my community that do this, to learn from them, because there is so much knowledge. You know, I think about the 20 plus years of guitar playing and guitar knowledge I have, and now I imagine that, you know, however many fold higher in the bird hunting community. So there's so much to learn and people who are so passionate about it. And, you know, for me, it something I really like is not taking part in the industrial, you know, meat industry and really feeling connected to the land around me and, you know, learning about that, you know, learning about what birds are eating or where they may come from or, mm-hmm. you know, their yeah. age through these super old bands you find yeah. on them. It's so cool. And I'm very lucky to have moved to a place where it's such a rich opportunity around me to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think if you can find a group of duck hunters and, you know, get a hold of them and say, hey guys, I'm going to bring coffee and breakfast sandwiches. Mind if I join you? They're going to be like, yeah, you know? And, yeah, getting involved with your ag communities too is just huge. It's just huge. And that's advice that I often give and people rarely take it. But if there is if you're a coyote guy and you're not going to the sheep herders meetings, you're missing the boat, man. Like those people are hurting from coyotes. They need help. Like go listen to them, make those relationships. You're going to get all kinds of access to go coyote hunting. Mm. If you're a waterfowl guy, find the ag producers who are growing grain crops and do the same thing. Like go to their meetings and sit down and, you know, if it's a potluck, you know, bring some fried chicken or whatever. And like develop those relationships and figure out, you know, what is it within their profession that's causing the problems, that's something that you can help with. And, you know, if that's building fence or, you know, burning ditches or like who knows what, there's probably a task that you can do that would help them a lot and would be of a high enough value that they'll trade, you know, your effort for access to be able to go hunt. And I hear from so many people that they say, oh, I offered to build fence, you know, for such and such and so and so. But man, I just don't know any ranchers who have ever actually had somebody show up who has fencing equipment with them, knows how to build fence and makes that offer. Mm. So it's something that people talk about, but don't actually do. And there's tremendous opportunities for access there. And then there's a lot of opportunities on public land as well. Mm-hmm. I think that you're really going to love upland hunting. You like hiking around. You're extremely physically fit. And you love dogs. I think that might be a direction that you're really well suited for. And that's another really long season. You know, that goes from the beginning of September to, you know, well into the winter.
Yeah.
And it's something that's pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. I'm excited to explore that for sure.
Yeah. And the Remington 870, like that's a great gun. It's always been a great gun. It's been a great gun since the beginning. And you don't need to go away from that one until you're ready.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, you know, buy once, cry once, but.
Well, yeah. I mean, ultimately, you're going to end up with more guns. Like, that's just kind of how it goes. I think you probably have more than one guitar, I would just guess. But
yeah, I've already got more than one gun as well. Yeah. Is the N plus one rule a thing in the gun community?
N plus one, I don't know that.
Okay, so the N plus one rule is something that is often cited in both the bicycle and guitar communities as the correct number of guns to have.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Is always equal to N plus one, where N is the number of that thing you currently have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, something that happens with guns that a lot of people, especially spouses, don't realize is if you put them in the gun cabinet together and then you lock it and then there's a full moon, what will happen is those guns will actually reproduce and new guns will just show up and they'll be in the gun safe the next time you open it. And, it's not always a full moon. Like it can occur during other moon phases, but anytime that you confine guns in a space, it's just inevitable that, you know, they will multiply. Hmm. And it's difficult to explain. It's kind of an anomaly. but it happens, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it happens.
I guess I'll have to get one of them cases.
I think the Minuteman might be one of those.
Yeah, I think yeah, you're right.
We'll
yeah.
see.
It'll fit a couple in there for sure.
We'll see if it has reproductive capabilities or not.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Hmm. I'll put it outside under the full moonlight.
Yeah, yeah. Recharge it like a I don't know. Is that what the hippies do with crystals? I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I read about that somewhere. Okay, where can people sort of find out more about what you're doing and what DECT is doing, like if they want to look into the stuff that we're talking about, if they want to, you know, get a magical case that allows firearms to reproduce, or if they want to get a full-on DECT drawer system, any of that stuff, like where do they go?
There's two excellent places to go. The best is DECT.com. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty straightforward. And that's the website. It's got all the best resources, tech specs. If you want a little bit of social media and mix some entertainment along with, you know, top tier ambassador highlights from folks like yourself, James Nash, and the team of excellent folks that we work with, our Instagram handle is DECTUSA. Mm-hmm. And those are really the two best places. You know, I have a social media handle, but yeah. I'm not too active on there. So yeah. I'd say hit up DECT. You'll see a little bit of me. You'll see a lot of ambassadors and a lot of other really great content on there.
Yeah. And it's all good fun. It's all good fun. It's not strictly business.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No. It's not strictly business on there.
Yeah. I like that. Well, it's been really cool hunting with you. It's been cool hanging out. And I would give an awful lot to be able to experience hunting for the first time. And it was cool to be able to sit next to you while you got to experience that, especially on such a special morning. That was a great one. That was all time.
It was one for the books for sure. It was a real honor to be invited, and thank you so much for opening the door yeah. in that way to me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Well, we need to go get your duck packaged up and get you on the road. So thank you very much for your time, and thanks for your stories. That was fun.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Cool. All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you all very much for listening. I'm going to keep bringing you these stories from normal people just like you who have done extraordinary things. Everyone is an expert at something, and they have interesting perspectives on life and work and the environment and all of the things that we care about. I'm going to keep bringing that to you. And I want to thank you so much for making this show possible. I also want to thank Emily Bratcher for producing this show. She does a great job editing. Really appreciate her. I want to thank John Chatelain. He did the art for the Six Ranch podcast. And Celia, soon to be Harlander, she digitized that so that we can get it out there on the internet for you. Also want to thank Justin Hay for writing this original music and the beautiful whistling that you're listening to right now. You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. Please keep listening to the show. Write me a review if you feel like it. And just keep doing your thing, and we'll all learn from this together. It's been fun, and you know, we're just getting started.